Welcome to Navigating Parental Alienation, the podcast. I'm Jacqueline Rourke. If you're dealing with the unfounded rejection of your child or children, or you believe they're being influenced to stop seeing or communicating with you, you're in the right place. Parental alienation is confusing, it's isolating, and it's misunderstood. This podcast aims to guide parents who are dealing with alienation and those trying to help them. We'll talk about what it is, how to transform from a traumatized to an empowered parent, how to engage family and friends so they understand, how to improve your sleep and stop catastrophizing, how to live without the guilt or shame, and how to reconnect with your alienated children. Keep listening because you're not alone and you can get through this to the other side. I know because I was there too and I've reconnected. So I've spent most of my career as a journalist on radio and later on TV. The thing I love doing most is interviewing people, especially people who are passionate about what they do and people who have something interesting, new, and important to share. So when I hear an interview on the radio with a researcher who has spent the past 3 decades investigating lying and cheating, I was all ears. So I contacted this researcher to bring his findings to you because they are really relevant and very helpful for parents who are dealing with alienation. So some of his key findings to listen for. 1, our society is built on trust. 2, when children make a promise, they take it very seriously. That's important for alienated parents to know. 3, using positive reinforcement. In this case, it's trust. Instead of negative reinforcement, like threats, like losing a privilege or being labeled a liar. Positive reinforcement is way more effective in teaching our children to be honest. And more importantly, trust strengthens the bond between parents and children. 4, listen to what he says about the current trend of helicopter parenting, hovering over our kids and not giving them freedom to explore. It tells children that we don't trust them, and that hurts our bond with them. And finally, listen to what he has to say about whether humans can accurately tell when a person is lying or not. And that includes if judges are able to detect when someone is lying to them. This is important research, so stay tuned. There is fascinating research from Harvard, the University of Toronto, and the Hangzhou Normal University in China. It reveals the role of trust in helping children learn about honesty. Professor Kang Li is one of the researchers involved in this study. Professor Li is a member of the Department of Applied Psychology and Human Development at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education at the University of Toronto. He holds the Tier 1 Canada Research Chair in Moral Development and Developmental Neuroscience and is a globally recognized scholar. Professor Li has spent much of his distinguished career investigating the development of deception, as in lying and cheating. Why is this relevant to our audience? Well, Professor Li discovered the critical role that trusting our children plays in their development. Welcome, Professor Li, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what brought you to be interested in why children lie?
For most of the studies in the world, we care a lot about the early development of honesty. However, for some unknown reason, the majority of psychologists will not study how children learn to tell lies and how they learn to cheat. So I thought, maybe there is need to study this topic so that we can learn about it and then learn how to promote honesty among our young children.
Okay, great. So how did you go about doing this latest study and what did you discover about the role of trust?
Mm-hmm. So I've been studying how children learn to lie and to cheat for about exactly 30 years, actually. And So one of the things that we have discovered is that children actually begin to cheat and lie at a very young age, somewhere around 2.5 years of age, which is somewhat surprising possibly to some of your audience and to many people. At the same time, and sometimes when they lie, they cheat, they actually do so quite strategically so that we adults may not be able to detect them. So therefore, there's a tremendous amount of need for us to kind of instill honesty from a young age, not by discovering they are lying, but just, you know, help them to learn, you know, when they make decisions, they should choose to tell the truth rather than lying or cheating. So in the study we did, we thought about, you know, and sometimes we ask our children to do things for us. And sometimes we frame them as kind of chores, you know, can you take out the garbage for me? You know, can you clean up the dishes? Instead, we thought maybe, you know, we can, if we turn this into a task of trust, entrustment, maybe children can, you know, feel that they are being trusted. Then they may do something for you. In addition to that, they become honest. So in this study, what we did is very simple. Since we are taking kids to take a test in a testing room, these are kindergarten kids. And then we say, okay, no, my hands are full. Could you please hold my household keys? And they are very important. Without that, I cannot go home. And then they just hold the keys, and then we take them to the testing room. But in the testing room, we just give them a normal, you know, test. And the answer sheet to the test or actually on the next table to where they are sitting. Then we make an excuse and leave the room. To our surprise, that if you ask children, you know, that you are going to trust them with this very small task, and they are less likely to cheat than children who have not been asked to do something like that. So that gives us. So then we looked further into.
So just
the situation.
Just so I'm clear, you entrusted these kindergartners to hold on to your keys, and did you say,
yes,
like, I trust you to hold the keys?
Excellent question. So we said a few things. So we said, okay, you know, they hold our keys and they keep our keys until we arrived at the room, and then we take the keys back. So, oh, you know, you did such a good job. You know, I will trust you to do this in the future, and that's it.
Okay.
And it turns out, so these two things are important. One is you entrust them to do something, then you say it that you like what they have done, and they will trust them to do it again in the future. By saying that, and children are less likely to cheat. But if you only do one thing, you know, if you just give kids something to hold on to, and then, you know, and then take the test without saying that you will be trusted to do it again in the future, then they will cheat. So this gives us some understanding that, you know, how entrustment works in childhood. That is, you as an adult entrust a child to do something, and then you have to articulate that once they have done so, and you have to articulate your appreciation of their work, and then you also have to articulate that you are going to trust them again in the future. So this has to be more explicit.
So can we go back to the study? Then these kindergartners go in, they take a written test at a table, and you say the answer sheet is on a table next to them?
Yes.
Do they know that it's the answer sheet?
Yes, they know. And they are not, when we leave the room, we say, you're not supposed to look at the answer sheet.
Okay.
Of course, this is our setup, you know. And most of the kids, if you do not entrust them, the cheating rate is about 50%. But if you entrust them, then the cheating rate goes down to about 20-some percent.
Interesting. And you're in another room watching through a two-way mirror.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. We have hidden cameras in the room everywhere, so we can tell whether or not they have cheated. Yes.
So this is kindergartners.
Yes.
Can you extrapolate these findings and from the work you've done over your career to consider what role trust is for older children?
Yes. So we have done a lot of things to looking at ways to promote honesty. So this is just one of the most recent ideas we have tested. And one of the most robust findings we have done in the past was to ask children to promise you to tell the truth or promise you to do something. And it turns out children take their promises very, very seriously. I'm talking about very, very young children. They are 2 and 3 years of age. If you ask them to promise you to tell you the truth, for example, they are highly likely to tell you the truth. So promising is also a very, very important method to promote honesty. And another very interesting method is to telling children moral stories, but not kind. We parents actually tell kids, for example, we tend to tell kids stories such as the boy who cried wolf, you know, the Pinocchio story. And these stories actually do not promote honesty. So
they're going at it from a negative tact, you're saying. These are negative stories, yeah.
Exactly. So that's the whole point is because we actually are using threat to deter them from cheating. And the kids, for some reason, just does not buy the threat. So they would come to lie or cheat. However, if you tell them more positive stories, so this is the positive story we Canadians don't hear very much, but the Americans all know about it. It's called the George Washington and the cherry tree story. Have you heard of this story?
Oh, yeah. I cannot tell a lie.
Yes. And, so this story, so just in case your audience have...
Yeah, please tell it.
So this story goes like this. So George Washington, when he was a boy, and he got the gift from his father, it's an axe. So he really likes the axe. So he goes, he chopped this and chopped that, and he chopped down his father's much cherished cherry tree. And his father discovered his cherry tree was chopped down, so he asked, who chopped down my cherry tree? And George Washington said that, I cannot lie. So, Dad, I chopped down your cherry tree. And George Washington's father said, I would rather have an honest boy than 1,000 cherry trees. So when we read this story to kids, they become more honest.
So then
we thought, why that? So you said, it's because it's positive, right? We want to test it out. So we changed the George Washington story into a negative story. That is, George Washington chopped down the cherry tree and lied about it. And it was scolded by his father. And when you tell that story, children then start to lie and cheat. So as you can tell, so the positive messaging to kids are more important than negative messages to kids, which is something we don't do in our daily life.
So interesting. But it also speaks to the innate nature or even need for trust. Like, what can you tell us about the role of trust in just one's perception of self? It sounds like it's very crucial.
Yes, excellent. This is an excellent question. So in the last 10 years or so, we start to understand, the role of trust that plays in human relations for young children. When I say young children, I'm talking about infants. So infants are just around 1 year of life start to understand whom to trust. They already pick up this information before 1 year, 12 months of age. So they know, they watch around in people who are interacting with them or to others, and they can pick out whom they can trust and whom they cannot trust. I'm talking about very, very young kids. So they are paying very close attention, watching you, the parents, the neighbors, or whatever. And then they start to build this idea that if this person is trustworthy, then I want to learn something from this person. So they are more likely to learn from someone they think is trustworthy. And they do not want to learn something from another adult who appears to be not reliable and not trustworthy. So they start to understand this. And from that point, and they start build this theory about humans that is, if the person is trustworthy, then, there are many other things I can do. The person will not lie to me, of course, and the person would tell me the things about the world that is something I need to learn. And then there are other things that, you know, if I'm going to ask the person to do things for me, is the person I'm going to be forming, you know, a good social relationship with? Or if it's another child, the child's, okay, is this person going to be my friend? So all that start to be built upon this understanding, who is trustworthy and who is not trustworthy.
But did you identify signs that infants detect that makes a parent or a person trustworthy or untrustworthy? What were these infants picking up on?
Yes. So, for example, so things like, are you consistent? So, for example, you know, sometimes, you know, think about this. The kids really hate this. So parents will say, you know, oh, you know, tomorrow, you know, I'm going to take you to the park. And something happens. I'm sorry, I'm not going to take you to the park, right? And the kids actually remember this and find that super, super annoying because you already promised me something and you're not living up to it. So this is the one situation. So the, you know, you're talking to a, let's say a toddler, you know, 14, 15 a month of age, they actually understand what you're talking about. And if you behave, do things inconsistently, and then they are not going to trust you.
Do you keep your word?
Exactly. And then also they monitor whether or not you say something and it turns out to be not true. For example, you know, you don't know something, and you say, you know, there's something you don't know. Instead of you say, I don't know, you make something up. And then if the child finds out, I'm talking about still very young kids or toddlers, they find out that, you know, what you said to them was not true. And they start to not trust you as well. So because your knowledge somehow is unreliable, inaccurate. So they pick up this kind of situation. And of course, they notice sometimes you lie to them. So that's another thing we also do all the time, and we do not realize this, which I call parenting by lying. So we adults sometimes, you know, do things in the name of parenting, but we actually lie to kids. So for example, we say, if you continue to throw tantrum in the grocery store, I'm going to call the police and they would arrest you and they would put you in jail. All that, is, of course, is not true. Just empty threat. And they learn that very quickly.
And you've also established that they don't even respond as well to threats. It's the positive reinforcement that's more powerful.
Exactly. So and then they then form ideas about how trustworthy you are as well. So then they learn in the future they will lie back to you. So I'm not talking about now young kids. I'm not talking about kids all the way up to actually university students now. So basically they grow up in an environment. The parents, for example, are lying to them. In the name of parenting, the kids are more likely to lie back to them.
To lie back, yeah. So would you say that trust plays an important role in the development of a bond between parent and child? It seems like a self-evident question, but what can you say about the role of trust in developing that bond between the parent and the child?
Trust is one of the cornerstones of human relations. So it's a very, very interesting. It's a very philosophical question as well. That is, what is trust? Trust is you actually put yourself in a vulnerable situation when you trust someone, because you don't know whether or not a person is actually trustworthy. So think about this. You know, today we made an appointment to have this this call, you and I never met before, right?
Correct.
And we just through email, but you actually, you know, put your afternoon 2 o'clock time in my hand. What if I did not show up? What if I did not take your call, right? So this is put yourself in a vulnerable situation. But of course, this kind of minor situation. But there are many, many situations in our world. For example, you take a bus. Can you trust the driver? Can you go to see a doctor? So all that is, so trust is something that you put yourself in a vulnerable situation when you actually have limited information about the other person.
You know, the other day I was driving down the road. It's so funny. This thought never crosses my mind. And there was a car coming toward me and it just went over the center line a bit and then went back. And it occurred to me, like at the speeds that we're going, and we're just feet apart, really, there's so much trust involved in just driving.
Totally. I mean, you know, you go to a stop sign how do you know that person is not going to run through these stop sign, right? So you put a lot of trust in others, and this is how the society is built. The society, our society is built on trust, because in the old days, I'm talking about in the early days of humanity, you have kings living together. So we are relatives, so we're family members. That's okay, right? We know each other. But then with the evolution of human society, we become larger and larger, and we encounter mostly strangers in our life. So if we don't have trust in these strangers, there will be nothing happening in human activity. So the fundamental kids, of course, we teach kids to trust, and kids learn to trust from very young age just for that purpose. But the cornerstone, of course, is the trust between the child and the mother, mostly the mother. I'm sorry to say that, because the mother in our society still tend to spend the majority of time working with kids as soon as the child is born. So the bond between the mother and child starts very, very young, and it continues all the way throughout our life.
Now, conversely, what role does not trusting our children do to the parent-child bond, would you say? If you've indicated, because you talked before about they can detect it.
Yes, yes. So you think about, this also happens all the time. You know, remember the helicopter parenting idea?
Yeah.
You know, that's becoming more and more common in our society, and the parents are overly anxious and overly protective. And that's what's happening, is we're taking away the trust from kids. So we, instead of trusting them, you know, to do certain things, we are now just flying over them and worried about everything they do, and they may fall, and we become, you know, make a big fuss about their falling and, you know, injured here and there a little bit, you know, and has bruises here and there and things like that. So by then, these are little things we kind of do to our kids, and slowly the child loses self-efficacy and self-confidence. And then the child slowly are not going to explore the world around them. They want someone to be around them, you know, the parent to be there and to take care of them, to watch over them. So then eventually the child is difficult to develop a full, you know, independent self.
Yeah, this helicopter parenting gives the message, I don't trust you to be able to handle this situation or to handle yourself.
Exactly. And your emotions. And it's, you know, many are just not just doing things, but emotions. How you manage your emotion when you facing frustration, facing difficulties, and facing setbacks, and facing injuries, all that.
Boy, that's got me thinking. Now, parents model so much for their children. You know, I guess the best way to teach a child to trust that they can handle a difficult situation is for the parent themselves to be able to handle the difficult situation.
Exactly. So kids actually, you know, one of the best learning methods is not through teaching, but through modeling. So kids watch you and they learn from you through how you interact with others, and how you respond to emotional stress, setbacks, and frustrations. And all that, they pick them up, and then they use it when they encounter frustration and setbacks. Or when you lie in certain situations, and they say, oh, this is how you deal with the situation. And they lie in similar kind of situations. So the parents really have to set a very good role model for their kids. It's difficult to be a parent, you have to really, you know, behave yourself in front of your child.
Yeah, but also interestingly, your research only said to those children, those kindergartners back in that sort of study, you only said it once, "I trust you." So it sounds to me like, even if you only have the opportunity to say it a few times, that message can really sink in deep with children.
Yes, we were surprised. We only said just one single time and in passing. You know, it's just because the whole thing is about testing. So the whole thing, we talked to them, you know, oh, we're going to take you the test, and et cetera, et cetera. And then they went, finished, and they say, "Oh, wait, we can trust you to do it again." And then, you know, you go in and do the test. Because one single messaging is enough for them to do, to be honest, one time right afterwards. Then just, so we haven't really done studies to follow up, you know, how many times we can, how many messages we need to give to the child so the child would have a lasting honesty in the next few months or years of their life. You know, we don't know. We have no data for that. Mm-hmm. The idea is in your everyday activity, if you sprinkle these mm-hmm. kind of trusting to your kids here and there, and they, I'm sure they're going to pick up and then turn all these sprinkles of entrustment into something. They say, "Oh, I'm trusted. Now I can do it because I'm trusted by mom or my dad, and I also need to be honest."
Yeah, can you repeat again, because you touched on it very briefly before, but turning chores, okay, you got to do the dishes now, turning chores yeah. into what you call trust tasks.
Yes. So let's reframe these tasks at home, and we call them chores, and kids hate chores.
Yes.
And just turn around, just like Tom Sawyer. You know, Tom Sawyer really was smart. He turned something mundane, painting the picked fences, into a game, and it's something fun, and he sold it to the other kid, right? Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not asking parents to lie to your kid, but if we can reframe these activities, household activities, not as chores, but as tasks that we trust them to do, I think kids would take them and do it willingly and feel very good about it. And the bonus of that is that they also become honest to you. So I think, you know, there's a lot of upside to reframe these household activities into trust tasks.
Very interesting. I think it's very offensive when we feel, when someone gives us the impression that they don't trust us, when our trustworthiness is called into question, it's offensive. And I guess this is what it's triggering.
Yes. So I was talking to a parent, and she said, you know, once she was waiting the bus and the kid forgot something, and she sent her back to her house to pick up something she forgot to bring, and she came back, and the feeling she had is tremendous amount of pride. You know, I know we sometimes, the parents, you know, by not giving kids these tasks, kids, you know, you lose the opportunity for them to have these incredible feelings about themselves.
Good point. Now, you've also said that parents should not overreact when they discover that their children have lied. It's really a trigger
yes.
for a lot of parents. You lied?
Yes.
I'm guilty
yes.
of that. Why shouldn't we overreact?
Okay. So number one, most of kids would lie in their life. Not extremely many times, but occasionally. So the reason for that is, you know, kids are learning the rules of society or rules of the household. You know, you tell them don't do this and don't do that, and they have to learn how to not to do it. But it's difficult because it's a learning process. So when they are young, they are going to break some of the rules. And then when they break some of the rules, and then when you corner them, and so who did this? You know, who break this? Did you do this? Did you brush your teeth? And if the child didn't. And when you corner them, they suddenly had no other alternative, and they would come up with a lie. So, no, I brushed my teeth, or I didn't do it, or my brother did it. Whatever it is. So because they are under the pressure and cornered. And when kids lie to you, it's a very good sign. So they realize, you know, by moving my lips, I actually can fend off the negative consequences from you. So what does lying require? Lying require that when I lie, I have to know you don't know what I know. Otherwise, there's no point of lying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Also, I have to inhibit my impulses to say the truth. and instead to create an alternative world and then describe that world to you.
It's very creative. So that,
yeah, these two things are, one is called executive functioning or self-control. Mm-hmm. The other one is called the mind reading. So self-control and mind reading are two most important skills that a child must learn in early childhood and throughout the childhood, and to strengthen it so that the child can live in a human society when they interact with other people. So if you don't have these two things, you're going to have difficulties. So, for example, children with ADHD cannot be able to tell lies. Children with autism spectrum syndrome cannot lie very well. And the reason for that is both of them have difficulty in self-control, and the children with autism spectrum syndrome tend not to have both. That is, they have difficulty reading other people's mind. They also have difficulty of self-control. So they cannot lie. So lying is a very good sign that your child has arrived at a normal stage of development. So there's nothing to be alarmed about. As a matter of fact, because, you know, the majority of kids start to lie about 2 years of age, but only a third of them would lie. And about 70% of them will confess to their transgressions. So those kids who lie at two actually developed earlier the ability to read minds, the ability to have self-control. So this is basically so what I always tell the parents, you know, if you see your kids lie at 2 and 3 years of age, instead of being alarmed, you should celebrate. You should pop a champagne in the stomach. Oh, my child made it, you know. and so there's nothing to be worried about your child's lying. But of course, you can use the occasion not to, like, when you discover your child's lying, right, you should use this occasion to talk about, you know, what is expected of them. But not using this opportunity, for many parents, they use the harshest punishment mm-hmm. when they it's lying, which just this is the worst thing you can do to your child, because then your child will learn next time I'm going to lie better, so they are going to improve their ability to tell lies. So, and most of the time, kids lie only occasionally, only when they are cornered.
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess that when you call out a lie, it can almost be done in such a way that you're shaming the child.
More than that, because there's a stigma about this, and then you see you are a liar. Some parents not only say...
So now you're labeling.
You're labeling the person, and then basically put some kind of trait statement into the person, as if, you know, the child will never change in his life. He will be a liar forever. You know, so all these kind of negativity will be associated with, you know, if we call someone as a liar. So anyhow, so the only thing I would say, you know, parents should watch out is when your kids lying all the time, and their lies can be easily detected. So, and that's a sign, you know, you have to of the child has some problems with mind reading or with self-control. So these are associated. And then there's a very, very, very rare case of situation in which kids are lying for fun, not to get them out of trouble, but to get others into trouble just for fun. And these kind of situations may be indicative of some kind of early personality disorders. But in my whole life, I've never met one single child. I've seen like close to, you know, more than 10,000 kids. I've never encountered one child who lied in this particular way.
Wow. This line keeps coming back to me. We rise or fall to the expectations of others. Does that say anything to you in terms of your research? If we expect someone to lie, or we expect them to be trustworthy?
This is so interesting. So this actually is probably not what you have in mind. So the interesting thing we discovered was, so basically what happened was, so parents, teachers, police officers, whoever who interact with kids a lot, they actually cannot detect children's lies. The reason is we actually believe, we have a bias, children are not lying to us. So that's why they get away with their lies, because in our head, we have this notion kids do not lie to us, including our parents to our own kids. And even when we tell them your kids may lie to you, somehow this bias is very highly ingrained in our head. We do not believe that's the case. Therefore, we tend to give our children the benefit of the doubt. So is that what you had in mind about expectations? So what I'm saying is we actually, in our head, we expect them to be truthful.
But for the from the child's point of view, if their parent has said, you're a liar, versus I trust you to do this, that's who I mean rising or falling to the expectation.
Yes, yes. So that's what I meant by cornering. So when cornering, typically what happens is, you know, the parent expects the child to do something, the child fails to do. Or the parents expect child not to do something, the child does it, right? And then that the mom or dad comes over and says, did you do this? And so this is, and then, you know, sometimes with some kind of threat in the air. And when that happens, you know, the child is kind of under that pressure. And then in order to get out of the pressure, and they would resort to lying to meet with your expectation that they are supposed to do what they are supposed to do, or they are supposed not to do what they are not supposed to do.
So I know you're not a parenting counselor, but you've looked at this closely. Do you have advice? What would be a good way for a parent to handle a situation when they've encountered that they know that their child has lied to them? What's the positive way to do it?
Yeah. So the most important thing is what we said at the very beginning, do not be alarmed. And it's just a normal part of growing up. It's also a normal part of human life that is sometimes we lie to each other. So then the next step is use the situation, not cornering the child. And you can use this opportunity to talk to your child if the child admits lying, and then use this opportunity to talk about lying and your expectations and the consequences of lying and the moral obligations we typically have to be honest, and also about trust. So you use that as a teachable moment.
You say you've been studying lying for 30 years. From the studies that you've done, and surely all the studies you've read, is it possible to tell with any certainty when a person is lying or not? You talked about children. What about adults? You know, we've been told like when they touch the nose or their eyes are darting around, you know, that you could tell a person's lying.
Yeah. I've not only studied lying among kids, I've studied lying among adults as well. So this is something we, you know, the general public does not know. That is, there are no telltale signs of lying. So it's, you cannot use one behavior to indicate someone's lying. So such as the person has shifty eyes, you said touch their nose, and being nervous, and the face is flushed, you know, all that, they actually do not give you reliable indication that person's lying. Even polygraph, you know, that using, you know, physiology to measure someone whether or not the person's lying is, you know, it's more than 50%, more than chance, but still not very reliable. So the accuracy rate is about 80%.
With right? The with the polygraph, with the lie detector, about 80%.
Yeah.
What about a judge? What about a judge that he's got two people in front of them? Are judges trained to tell who's lying?
No, they can't. So judges cannot make that. We have studied the judge when we ask them to judge whether or not kids are lying, and their performance is about 50%. So just chance them. So 50, flip a coin, 50-50. So the judge's ability to determine a child's lie or has lied or not lied, is 50%. Imagine that. So now you think about adults who are more, you know, have much better mind reading ability, much better self-control. So they obviously going to lie better than kids. So basically, if someone's telling you they can tell A and B you know, this person lying, that person not lying, that person is lying to you, basically, that woman telling you.
Wow.
So that just the evidence is very, very sound and very well established. So
very well established. That really kind of threatens a little bit our judicial system. If you're saying the evidence is very well established that you just can't tell.
Yes, you can tell, but there's one thing people, in the judicial system, so what you do is you weigh the probabilities of two sides. So typically during the discovery process, the both sides says, about same event, and they give two different versions. And then, so you basically weigh the evidence and then make a decision on one side, which is looks like more probable. And one of the key things we discovered with kids is that kids, when they, if you look at the behaviors, facial emotions and body language, there's no way you can tell the child is lying. But you can ask a number of questions to kids. And when a child is answering a series of questions, and then they are going to fall apart.
Their story, their story is going to fall apart, not the child themselves. Yeah, okay.
So they do as well. So what happens is because you create a alternative truth, and then with that, you have to build something logical around it. And the more questions you ask and the more answers they gave, at some point, things going to their whole system will appear. So this is, I think, what happens in judicial cases. Is people start to look for these inconsistencies in statements, but not, or evidence, but not in the way people are saying it. So that's very important. So basically, facial expression, body language do not reveal consistently someone lying or someone else not lying. But in words, however, because this is sometimes it involves these so-called autobiographical memory. Something never happened, and you say something happened. And then when you talk about, something never happened, when you keep on talking about this, there are going to be signs of falsity that would show up. So that's the part we need to pay attention to if we really want to detect someone lying or not lying.
This has been just fascinating, Professor Lee. I really do appreciate your time, and I really appreciate your research. It's important stuff.
Thank you so much. Really, you did such a great research. You have great questions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Kang Lee is a developmental psychologist and professor at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education at the University of Toronto. Really, thanks again for your time. I appreciate it, Professor Lee.
Thank you very much.
I found that really interesting. When Professor Lee said that children take their promises very seriously, that's important to understand because children in an alienation situation are caught in a loyalty conflict. The alienating parent typically wants the child's loyalty more than their love, and they will test the child's loyalty. For example, like when the child comes back from seeing the targeted parent, the one who is alienated from the children, the alienating parent will ask the child, did they have any fun? The child quickly learns that if they say yes, the alienating parent will be upset with them, often withdrawing their love. That's not me talking. That's one of the 17 alienating behaviors identified by PA experts. So alienated children will often be put in a position of promising that they love the alienator more than the targeted parent. So as targeted parents, or what I prefer to call bonded parents, we need to understand both the pressure these children are under to appease the alienator, but also the added pressure that their very nature puts on them, the fact that they take these promises very seriously. Another point, when Professor Lee talked about trust and how children starting around 12 months of age learn to identify who they can and who they can't trust, that is important for us to remember because targeted or bonded parents tend to be the ones who were consistent in children's lives, the ones who were reliable and who followed through with what they said they would do. The research does show that children tend to reject that parent because they know that that parent is going to be there. They're not necessarily feeling as solid with the relationship with the other parent. So that should give you hope, because even though an alienated child acts like they can't trust you, that's due to the messages and pressure from the alienating force. Deep down, they know who they can trust. And the study found that the researchers only needed to tell the children once that they trusted them for the child to respond positively to that message. In other words, even if you're not seeing your child often, if you can get that message across to them just once or even a few times, it can have a big positive impact on the child and on your bond with them. So the message for bonded parents is to trust this trust. Show your child that you are still dependable, and the trust that was developed at a young age will remain in their core beliefs, and it can be reignited when the child is ready. Another interesting point about some of the things he said, many alienators tend to be the kinds of people who put their needs ahead of the needs of others, including their children. I want you to ask yourself, did the alienator ever let me down or not follow through on promises to me? Well, chances are the answer is yes. And if so, you can be sure that they're doing that with your children. So again, have faith, because this research proves to us that our children do notice this. And as Professor Lee said, they hate the inconsistency and people not following through on their promises or commitments. So the alienator's own actions will eventually be their undoing. We've got to remain strong while our children are struggling to free themselves from the alienator. Again, know that the alienating force's own behavior and broken promises and their inconsistencies, that is being noticed by the children, and they will eventually see it for what it is. Professor Lee also said that children definitely notice when a parent tells them something that they later find out to be untrue. It just adds to the factors that tell children that that person who lied to them can't be trusted. So the messages here are, be consistent, keep your word, don't tell them lies. It's pretty basic stuff. We know this. But this is the stuff that most alienators have difficulty doing. I wanted to bring this important research to you because it should give you hope and guidance as you work to strengthen the bond that you have with your children. So find ways to make and keep commitments with them, even if you're not seeing them. And you have to know that it is working, even if the child doesn't or can't acknowledge your efforts. Keep your word. But telling the truth doesn't mean telling them what you think of the alienator. That's a big mistake. Don't go there. Keep those thoughts to yourself. Just focus on your love for your children and that you trust them. You trust their love and that they can trust that you will always be there for them when they're ready. Professor Lee also talked about helicopter parenting. Think about how the alienating parent might be acting with your child. Are they controlling? Do they monitor the child's actions and limit who they can see and when? All of that is eroding the child's trust, and that's working against the alienating parent. Professor Lee also reminded us that children learn most from modeling how we behave, not what we say. And they watch how we handle emotional stress, how we handle setbacks and frustrations, and how we respond to others. Again, picture the alienating force, the alienating parent. Think about what the children are learning from them. The research tells us that children notice how we behave and how we treat others, and that goes for the alienating parent as well. Finally, a big takeaway. He said there are no telltale signs that indicate someone is lying. I'm going to repeat that. He said scientific research has determined that there are no reliable signs to indicate a person is lying. Even lie detectors aren't completely reliable. If chance means that when you say a person is lying, you'll be right 50% of the time, either they are or they aren't. So half of the time you're going to be right, half of the time you're wrong. And lie detectors are only reliable 80% of the time, he said. Well, that means even with lie detectors, 20% of the time, one in five people can fool a lie detector machine. But without a lie detector machine, it's no better than a crapshoot. you're going to be wrong half the time. Professor Lee said they've even studied judges to see if they can detect if children are lying or not. And he said they can't. The judges were right only 50% of the time, which is the same as if they were guessing or they flipped a coin. And he said because adults have better mind-reading abilities and more self-control, they'd be even more capable of lying and not being detected by judges. He even emphasized that the science showing that people can't tell when others are lying is very well established. So think about that next time you have to be in court with the alienator. The judge can't tell with any accuracy if that person is lying to them. Instead, they rely on the consistency of the evidence and the information presented to them. So this is important. I have learned that how you behave in court is way more important to the judge than figuring out who's telling the truth or not. We're going to discuss a lot more in a future podcast episode about how to be in court. But remember, be calm, be cool, be collected, be confident. That is what the judge is going to notice most. I hope you enjoyed that interview. I will bring you more great experts in episodes to come. If you know or suspect that you're dealing with parental alienation, I encourage you to check out our website, navigatingparentalalienation.com or navigatingpa.com. You'll find lots of information, as well as my online course for bonded parents, Navigating Parental Alienation. As an award-winning journalist, I have searched through the best and most reliable sources and combined that information with the lessons I learned the hard way. I want to save you precious time, energy, and money by giving you the best information about how to survive parental alienation so you can manage the stress, avoid the pitfalls, and be ready to reconnect with your children. I invite you to join our community because you're not alone. Thanks for listening.